Hello and welcome to the Stumbled Upon podcast. I am your host, Kate, and each week we'll be taking a deep dive into a random topic that has sparked my interest. Before we get started, I hope that you are having a wonderful Friday and looking forward to the weekend ahead. This week's topic is the 1918 flu pandemic, and it may be better known as the Spanish flu, but that is actually not an accurate name for it. We'll get to that in a little bit. What sparked my interest in going down this particular rabbit hole is that I was watching the most recent episode of Murder, Mystery, and Makeup on YouTube with Bailey Sarian. It's one of the creators that I follow online, and she did an episode about this lady who had killed several of her husbands throughout her lifetime, and one of them was not initially labeled as murder because the doctors blamed his death on the flu because it occurred during 1918. So that made me start thinking about how I don't really remember learning much about the Spanish flu or the flu of 1918. And so I thought I would do a deep dive, and it's actually pretty interesting. It's a little bit science heavy, so forewarning for that, but I thought it was a cool sort of look into the way that we handled a pandemic back in the early 1900s. You may know it as the Spanish flu because people mistakenly thought that it started in Spain. The reality is that Spain was just the first country to talk about it publicly. The US and other countries that were involved in World War I at this time censored news of the illness because they feared that it would hurt morale. Spain wasn't involved in the war, so they didn't have that same level of censorship. The first cases of the flu are thought to have originated in a military base in Kansas of the United States. So, whoops, we started it. And from there, it spread with American troops throughout America and then overseas, moving quickly through crowded military camps. The estimated number of infected is as high as 500 million people, or one-third of the world's population at that time, and an estimated 50 million people died worldwide, with some estimates as high as 100 million deaths. Now, obviously, these are all just rough estimates because record-keeping was not necessarily as good as it is now back then, and so we're just going off of rough estimates. I'm not actually sure how they come up with estimates for the mortality rates of these diseases from, you know, back in the day. But regardless, it's a pretty big number. Whether you're looking at the low end of 50 million or the high end of 100 million, that's still a lot of people. In comparison to that, I did look up how many deaths worldwide have been attributed to COVID-19. And according to the World Health Organization, as of June 7th of 2025, the number was around 7.1 million people who have died from COVID. So that's a pretty big difference. If you think about how comparatively, especially to the population, 7 million people versus how many billions are on the planet, and then 50 million people, which would have been a fifth of the world's population, so or 20%. So that's a pretty high rate of infection and death from the flu. Now, the first wave of the 1918 flu was considered a minor outbreak. Those who caught it gained some immunization for the much worse second wave that began at the end of August 1918. Now, just as a side note, you gain immunity to viruses by exposure to them. So basically, this exposure will teach your immune system how to fight the virus so that when it quote unquote sees it again, then its reaction time to like killing the virus is quicker, and subsequently your recovery time tends to be a little bit quicker as well. This is essentially how vaccines work. So you get inoculated with a form of the virus that is usually modified in such a way that it's not deadly, and then your body learns how to fight it, and then you are better prepared to fight the virus when and if you come into contact with it in the natural environment. Now, the second wave of the 1918 pandemic is really interesting because it spontaneously began in three separate locations at once, one of them being Freetown, Sierra Leone, the other being Brest, France, and the third being Boston, Massachusetts. Unlike the usual influenza, which is most lethal in infants and the elderly, this outbreak targeted young adults between the ages of 20 and 40, which created a W curve on a graph. So if you think of, you know, usually the curve for things like the flu would be a U shape because it's most deadly in the very young and the very old. This one was unique in that it was a W shape because it was very young, sort of that middle ground, and then very old as well. Experts today still don't agree why this was the case, but the following are some explanations that they have come up with. So the first is that it was a reflection of the high impact on men in the military who were mostly young adults. So keep in mind that a very large number of people who were infected and subsequently died from this flu were men in the military. Additionally, some hold the theory that the stable conditions that exist when a population is relatively closed can change dramatically when exposed to new pathogens and/or suddenly in communication with host populations of different susceptibility. So, an example of this is a study that found a virulent rabbit hemorrhagic virus emerged when a large population of rabbits were transported by plane from Germany to China in 1984. Had the mutated virus only appeared in Germany, it would have found that most nearby rabbits had some form of immunity to the older virus from which it had evolved. However, since it was carried by air travel to susceptible populations in China, the virulent strain was favored and rapidly changed the evolutionary stable state. This model can be applied to the populations during and after World War I, which disrupted many stable local populations by both the movement of troops and refugee migrations that occur with any major conflict. Essentially, what this means is that when you have a population that is sort of relatively closed, right? So not a whole lot of incoming people from outside environments, that population's immunity as a whole is relatively stable. When you start introducing populations from outside of that group, you are introducing new pathogens, new strains of viruses, that kind of thing. And so the original immunity of the group is not equipped necessarily to handle these new strains. And so essentially, the new strains of bacteria or viruses will run rampant in that population until the general population has sort of become inoculated against it and reaches a new level of stability in their immunity or their immune response, if that makes sense. That's sort of one idea of how this spread so rapidly and so readily is that it was moving around as troops were moving around and as refugees were moving around from populations that maybe were not necessarily as susceptible to the virus to populations that were much more susceptible to the virus, which makes it all the more deadly because now it's running through an entire population of people who are not equipped to handle it. Additionally, they also wonder if it's because young adults had not yet been exposed to a similar strain of the flu, so their immune systems were less effective at fighting it. There was a flu outbreak, it said in the article that I was reading, in the late 1800s. And so if you looked at the ages of people that were coming down with the flu in 1918, they would not have been exposed to the flu virus that was around in the 1880s. And that particular flu was a little bit more aggressive. And so the flu virus that they had been exposed to up to that point was not from that more aggressive strain of flu. And so that's why they think that this particular group of the population was more susceptible to it because they just had not been exposed to that more aggressive strain of flu virus. Because if you didn't know, the flu virus has a bazillion different strains, and that is why they have to make a new flu vaccine every year because they are, first of all, they're guessing as to which strain is going to be the most prevalent, and also the flu virus mutates at a pretty rapid rate, and so the strains evolve as time goes on. A major factor in the transmission of disease is the number of susceptible hosts in the population, the number of people who have been vaccinated against a virus or who have survived prior infection with the virus will affect its ability to spread. This is essentially what's known as herd immunity. So the more people who can successfully combat a virus with their immunity to it, the more they protect the members of the population without immunity. At this time, there was no vaccine against the flu virus. And as I said, it mutates rapidly and often. And so they just were not exposed. The herd immunity was not there when it came to these populations. Also, prior exposure in childhood to the flu virus can affect your lifetime susceptibility. And this idea that the young adult population hadn't been exposed to a prior version of this strain is offered to explain why this one was as deadly as it was. Acquired immunity is also determined by the density of the population in the areas where an individual lived. For example, in the American Revolutionary War, George Washington's American volunteers were far more likely to catch smallpox compared to British troops who had been recruited from the slums of cities in England, where they had either gained immunity from a previous infection or been vaccinated on enlistment. The article that I was reading discussed how during the Civil War in the South, Robert E. Lee had a camp that he would have his troops go, like new troops go to, where essentially it was like they didn't call it a quarantine camp, but that's basically what it was, where new troops went to get quote unquote seasoned. And basically it was, you go there, you get exposed to a bunch of germs that you've never been exposed to. Measles was one in particular at this time that they were working on immunity to. And so you'd get exposed to it, you'd either die or get immunity from it. And then once you were quote unquote seasoned, then you could go on to the military base that you were going to be assigned to. So they understood the idea that you needed to be exposed to these germs in order to not get as sick from them in the future. But they didn't really put any of this into practice in World War One, and part of the reason for that was because they needed to mobilize troops at a pretty rapid rate, so they didn't have time, I guess, for people to naturally gain immunity from disease. And also, I don't know, it didn't really discuss, well, there was no flu vaccine, so it's not like they could vaccinate them against the flu virus anyway when they joined the military. So basically it was, you know, they enlisted a bunch of men and they were crammed into really overcrowded military bases. And then the transportation from the United States to overseas was also overcrowded. So now you're like crammed into the transportation and you're just sharing germs at that point. And then from there, you know, they go to the military bases overseas, which were not exactly, you know, I mean, it's wartime, so it's not like it's a 5-star resort, right? And so then you're in these conditions overseas and you're just spreading these germs even more. And again, when you're moving from a population that has some kind of immunity to a population that has no immunity, then the virus just runs rampant. A study that was done at the site of the first outbreak at Camp Funston in Kansas by a lieutenant colonel in the medical corps found that the men who got the most sick and had the highest mortality rate were the black troops from Louisiana and Mississippi. He found that these troops were sick with varieties of pneumonia bacteria that were typically present in the mouths of healthy white troops already. The difference that he cited was the sick troops from Louisiana and Mississippi were from much less densely populated areas and therefore had a lower exposure rate. He did not study racial factors beyond stating that the black and white troops performed similar duties in similar conditions at the base. However, a shortfall of this research is that he didn't consider pre-existing malnutrition or other conditions like anemia from hookworm, which was a common infestation in the South. Additionally, there weren't any white troops from Louisiana and Mississippi for him to compare the mouth swab samples with. So essentially, he took mouth swab samples from healthy white troops from, the North, basically, and then these sick black troops from Louisiana and Mississippi. And he found that the bacteria that was in the black troops was the same as the bacteria that was in the white troops, but the white troops were not getting sick because they had already been exposed to this bacteria. So it wasn't, their body already knew how to handle it. And like, again, they did not take into consideration the background of these different troops. And so that doesn't paint a full picture of everything going on, because you can't just say like, oh, these guys are sick and these guys are healthy, but they all have the same bacteria in their mouth. Well, you also have to take into consideration that, yeah, their conditions currently may be the same, but what conditions did they come from that were different? What kind of conditions were in their childhood that were different? What kind of conditions, you know, changed their immune response that might be different? So they essentially blamed Southernness as the cause for the troops getting so sick, but It doesn't paint the whole picture. Unfortunately, no one preserved any lung tissue from the first wave outbreak, so modern virologists can't code the RNA from that original outbreak and compare it to the lethal strain that emerged in August. Based on a summary essay published in 1921, we know physicians believed the flu virus destroyed the immune protection of the bronchial tree, which caused pneumonia bacteria to thrive. Add on the fact that the pneumonia strains that were present in sick patients were normally considered non-pathogenic. At multiple military camps, they theorized that Southern troops, both black and white, had greater mortality due to their lack of previous exposure, and hookworm and chronic malarial infection in Southern troops increased their susceptibility. This also held true for troops from rural northern locations as well. Again, this review did not factor in things like poverty and issues from poverty like malnutrition, poor housing, lack of medical care, etc. You can't really be 100% sure, but it does make sense logically that people from more rural populations would be a more susceptible population to this flu virus and then the subsequent pneumonia that came after, because they just had not been exposed to it previously. Because again, population density does have an effect on the immunity of the population in question. Since no previous strains were saved, there's no way to say for sure what changed to make the second wave as deadly as it was, but it's assumed that a mutation set the stage for greater spread. The death rates were high enough to reduce the overall life expectancy of the American population by 12 years. The deadliest wave hit the U.S. civilian population between October and November of 1918. The emergency presented by the outbreak caused local governments to shut down schools, ban social gatherings, and call for the isolation of infected people and quarantine of their contacts. Does any of this sound familiar? This article that I read, by the way, that was like a scholarly paper that was posted or that was written looking at different studies from the outbreak, the 1918 outbreak, was written in 2018 or published in 2018. So the lens of being post-COVID is not over this paper whenever it was published. But I think it's safe to say that there are some kind of eerie similarities to the way this pandemic went, as well as how the COVID-19 pandemic went. Additionally, some communities also enforced masks, though they were made of gauze and considered ineffective. The race to find a vaccine also started using the strategy of injecting killed microorganisms into patients. However, no one regulated these trials, so a doctor would make up a few liters, distribute it to clinician friends, or try it out in institutional settings like orphanages or asylums. According to historian John Eiler, quote, "Regardless of the vaccine they tested or the approach they used, most researchers who published the results of influenza vaccine trials in 1918 concluded their vaccine was effective," end quote. Proper identification of influenza's origin as a virus did not come until the 1930s, however. And the first effective vaccines followed later. I believe one article that I read said that the first FDA-approved vaccine came, I think, in the 1940s, if I'm remembering correctly. So it was quite some time after that we actually had a working vaccine. vaccine against the flu. By the summer of 1919, the flu pandemic had come to an end as those that were infected either died or developed immunity. Since 1918, notable flu pandemics include one from 1957 through 1958 that killed around 2 million people worldwide, and one from 1968 to 1969 that killed approximately 1 million people worldwide. So at least these numbers are on a downward track. And I think that speaks to not only better immunized population, but we also have the vaccines during these times, these later pandemics. And I think we also have a better understanding of how these viruses spread. So there's a little bit better of awareness when it comes to hygienic practices, not overcrowding as much, and also just during these other pandemics. I think one of the things that really created the sort of storm of deadly conditions was the fact that World War I was going on and the news censored information about this flu infection. So people just didn't know what was going on. And if you don't know that you need to protect yourself around other people, then like, what are you supposed to do? If you don't know the information, then you can't make a behavioral change. So I think those are contributing factors certainly to why the influenza outbreak of 1918 was as deadly as it was. In conclusion, the flu outbreak of 1918 was unique in its deadliness, but also in the way that it was handled in the face of World War I. Perhaps things might have been different if soldiers' living conditions were different, and if countries didn't censor news about it. Either way, I think there's a lot that can be learned from this pandemic that could help us globally moving forward, especially as the world population continues to be increasingly mobile and intermingled. Stay healthy, friends, and I'll be seeing you next Friday. Bye!